Okay, so today is Monday, February 13th. We're going to be talking about EKG as a review. So let me get you started back with that old topic. I just want to make sure I clear up any kind of questions you guys have before we leave this one behind. So this cardiac cycle is about a 0.8 second cycle. This includes the entire heartbeat, which means atria contract first and ventricles contract second. So what we're looking at is five waves here. That first wave, the P wave, is the result of the SA node firing off an impulse. And that impulse would come right before the P wave shows up. Okay, so I'd say SA node fires about here. P wave then shows up as atrial depolarization. So in plain English, what does that mean? Getting ready to contract. Good. So P wave, atrial depolarization means we're getting ready to contract. Now, there's a little space here, and that's because the message has now reached our AV node, and the AV node now fires an impulse to the bundle of His, the bundle branches, up the Purkinje fibers, and now these ventricles are being told to get ready to contract. That's that big QRS wave, and that represents what? Good. Ventricular depolarization. Keep in mind that depolarization means you're getting ready to contract. The contraction event actually occurs afterwards. So let's go back for just a moment. We know the SA node fires right before your P wave, and then there's the P wave, which means the atria are getting ready to contract. Where do the atria actually contract?
Behind
the QRS wave. So that contraction is hidden. There is no wave that directly corresponds to atrial contraction.
So
likewise, go ahead.
Between the P and the Q, like the flat line,
right.
That's where, I guess you said the AV node is sending, I guess it's impulse through the ventricles to contract.
That's right. So there's, that's going to be where your SA node fires right before P wave, and then right before QRS is when AV node fires. Okay. So from the beginning, the SA node fires right before the P wave. The P wave is your atrial depolarization. Atria actually contracts hidden behind that QRS wave. Okay, back it up a step. We know the AV node fires after the P wave, before the QRS wave. That AV node tells the bundle of His, the bundle of branches, the Purkinje fibers to release a nerve impulse on your two ventricles. And then here at the QRS wave, what happens? Ventricular depolarization, meaning? Good, getting ready to contract. So they would actually contract at some point afterwards, say between S and T. And so that flat line there would actually be the time during which the ventricles contract. When we reach the T wave, that's the time period when the ventricles are resetting themselves. We call that ventricular what?
Repolarization.
Repolarization, good. And so T wave should show ventricular repolarization. And you know what? If the atria repolarize, and they do, that too is hidden behind the QRS wave. So the QRS wave is just so big, it kind of hides everything else that's going on. Now, if there is a U wave, and sometimes there is, that is actually repolarization of the papillary muscles. But I just want to show that because it's on this particular picture I put into your course pack. Does that help clarify the points here where everything occurs? Do you have any questions on the EKG?
Well, just one of our questions in the course pack, when it says well, the QRS wave there compares to the P wave, is that because there's atrial depolarization in the P wave and ventricular depolarization in the QRS wave?
Actually, it's entirely on the ventricles because they're more muscular. Their depolarization event's going to be greater and it's going to give you a much larger QRS wave than P. So it's not necessarily that you've got all this stuff piling up on itself, it's the size of the ventricles.
So that would be representing
the sodium and potassium mixture. That's right. You've got bigger,
like
bigger wave, the more so you have to depolarize that muscle. Yeah, exactly right. So this cardiac cycle is what we consider to be normal sinus rhythm. This is 0.8 seconds, which means that we assume a 75 beats per minute heart rate. Is there anything else I can help with for the EKG? While we're here, let's talk about diastole and systole as a way of review from last Wednesday. So starting off, can you tell me which one of these terms means contraction?
Systole.
Systole. Right. So if we just say contraction, we mean ventricular contraction, and that is systole. If we're talking about relaxation, that means diastole. So let's start from the top of the whole process. This is mid to late diastole, or the mid to late resting period for the ventricles. During the mid to late resting period, blood is flowing passively under low pressure into the two atria. The right atrium receives blood from three veins. What are they? Good. Now, all that blood is of what quality?
Deoxygenated.
It's deoxygenated. Good. So at the same time, blood flows into your left atrium. That blood is oxygenated, coming from where? Pulmonary veins. Good. And so we've got blood flowing simultaneously into each atrium, down through open AV valves. And of course, we've got a mitral valve or bicuspid on the left, tricuspid on the right. And that blood pools and collects in our two ventricles. About that time, the SA node fires an impulse. SA node sits up here in the top of the right atrium, and the message for the two atria is what?
Contract.
Contract, good. So the two atria contract, and that forces the remaining blood down through the open AV valves and into the two ventricles. Just as a side thought, what's going on with your semilunar valves right now?
They're closed.
Good. Okay. So the blood that is forced into each ventricle is about how much blood? 120 milliliters. So each ventricle contains 120 milliliters of blood, and that's known as our what? Good. End diastolic volume, or EDV for short. Good. So we are technically at the end of the relaxation period, which is known as diastole. Well, we know that the SA node's impulse travels to the atria, giving them a chance to contract first. There's a pause. And then that nerve impulse reaches the AV node, which sits over here close to the intraventricular septum. When the AV node fires, trace it with me down to the ventricles. Where does the message go next? Bundle of His.
Bundle
branches.
Purkinje fibers.
Good. And then each ventricle receives a nerve impulse telling it to contract. So about that time, the pressure is starting to rise, the ventricles start to contract, and those papillary muscles pull down on those semilunar valves, or AV valves, about to do the wrong thing, didn't I? So for just a brief moment, all four heart valves are closed, and this is known as what?
Isovolumetric.
Good, isovolumetric contraction phase. So for just a brief moment, all four heart valves are closed, but the pressure is really starting to gain steam here in the ventricles. It is so great that now we force open which valves?
Semilunar
valves, good. And so blood now is ejected out through your two arteries, aorta and pulmonary trunk. About how much blood is leaving each ventricle?
70.
Yeah, 70 milliliters, good. So we stroke volume out 70 milliliters from each ventricle, leaving behind how much blood?
50
milliliters. Good. That's a volume known as?
End-systolic volume.
End-systolic volume, or ESV for short. Good. Now, if you do the math here, the ejection fraction is about what? 55-60%, somewhere in that neighborhood. Okay. So we're going to functionally pump out a little more than half of the blood that came into the heart. So it's not that we're pumping out everything, we're just pumping out a portion of that blood. Okay, so we've opened up the semilunar valves, we're in systole here, blood is being ejected from the heart through the aorta and through the pulmonary trunk. Let's take the aorta for just a moment from the left ventricle. That blood is going where?
Systemic,
to the body, good. And blood from the right ventricle through the pulmonary circuit is going?
Lungs.
To the lungs, good for gas exchange. Okay, so when blood is ejected, you know, the pressure now is going to decrease. Which side of the heart, left or right, always has a higher pressure?
Left
side, good. During systole, what is left side pressure? 120, good. And during diastole, left side pressure is? About 80, right? Okay, so remember these numbers, 120 over 80. Those are really left side heart pressures. So during systole, the highest pressure is about 120. And during diastole, the highest pressure is about 80. So that's left side pressure because we're having to pump blood to the systemic circuit. Do you recall what the right side pressures are going to be? Right side heart pressure is really low. It's about 24 over 8. Okay, so the only pressure that you need there is to get that blood to the lungs, and that's a really low pressure. Okay, so now that blood has been ejected from the heart, there is nothing keeping those semilunar valves open. So the semilunar valves will eventually slam shut. All four heart valves are closed for a second time. This is known as an isoviometric relaxation phase, okay? And so this second time period allows for all four heart valves to be closed. Can you tell me what creates the lubbed up sound that we associate with the heartbeat? Good. Closing of the AV valves and closing of the semilunar valves, good. So it is in fact the valve closure that gives us the heart sounds of lubbed up that we associate with a heartbeat. Good. Okay, so are you getting a little more comfortable with diastole and systole? Natalie.
Okay, so like 2 seconds ago you're talking about that on the left side of the heart was 120 systole.
Right. That's right. Left side is 120 over 80. Right side is 24 over 8. Does that make sense?
I mean, it makes sense, but so would that be like the normal thing?
That is what we consider normal, like 110 to 120 over 70 or 80. We normally consider that normal for left side heart pressures. How you doing with diastole and systole? Do you need to go through one more time, or are you more or less comfortable there? One more time, sure. Okay, let's start at mid to late diastole. That is a relaxation phase. Blood drains into which chambers? Atria, good. So right atrium receives blood from SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. Left atrium receives blood from where?
Pulmonary
veins, good. Which side of the heart is receiving oxygenated blood?
Left side,
yep. Blood travels down through open valves. Which valves are currently open?
AV valves,
good. Blood collects and pools in the two ventricles. About that time, the SA node fires. An impulse tells the two atria to contract. How much blood pools in each ventricle? 120 milliliters, good. That's a volume known as? End-diastolic volume, good. Now, that blood is collected there in the two ventricles. Let's switch over here to the systolic picture because about this time, the AV node fires an impulse. That impulse travels down the bundle of His, the two branches, up the Purkinje fibers, telling these two ventricles to contract. And when those ventricles contract, what happens to the pressure in both ventricles?
Rises
and increases. Good. So the pressure increase is going to cause us to have papillary muscles contract. They will help us slam shut which valves?
AV valves.
Good. So the AV valves are forced closed. And of course, for just a brief moment, we haven't yet opened your semilunar valves. So we're in an isovolumetric contraction phase right for this brief moment. But then, of course, the pressure now is so great that the semilunars are forced open. Where does the right ventricle send blood?
Pulmonary
trunk out to the lungs. What circuit is this? Pulmonary circuit. Good. Left ventricle contracts. It sends blood up through the aortic semilunar valve and where? Good. To the body. It is systemic circuit. So the pressure must be greater on which side of the heart?
The left side.
Yes. So during systolic contraction, what do we expect to have in terms of pressure on the left side? 120, right. So 80 during relaxation, 120 during contraction. So the amount of blood that is ejected from each ventricle is known as a volume called?
Stroke
volume, right. And what you leave behind is called?
End systolic
volume, good. How much blood do you stroke out with each contraction? 70 milliliters, right. That means each ventricle is going to send out 70 mils, leaving behind how much in each ventricle? 50 milliliters in each ventricle. So the ejection fraction is the percentage of blood that you're pumping out, and that's around 60%, 60% of your blood is pumped out with each contraction event, and that is considered to be good. Okay, so not many places 50 to 65% is a good percentage, but it is for ejection fraction. Okay, so once the blood is pumped out through your two large arteries, there is no more pressure keeping those valves open. So which valves now slam shut?
Semilunar
valves, good. This creates a heart sound known as?
Dup.
Yep. Lub was closing the AV valves, and a shorter, quicker dup is the closer of those two semilunar valves. So the whole thing here is that the valve closure creates those lubbed up noises we associate with heart sounds. One thing you may want to do is, I'm not sure how many are using the recording, but if you are recording, that's great. Listen to this conversation. When I ask a question, pause it and see if you can answer the question. This counts for probably 10 test questions. So if you can replay and answer me as we go through, you've got this stuff made, okay? Is there anything I can help with, any part I can clarify for you guys on this topic? Are you comfortable yet to tell the story to somebody else? Not yet? Okay. If you're not quite comfortable, you've got, 2.5 weeks to get there. But if you can tell this story to somebody else, starting from the top, going all the way through, that's where you want to be come test day. More so multiple choice, like volumes, pressures, where's the blood moving, you know, what's contracting, that kind of thing. Say that again. Like pressures and volumes, I'll use the same ones you've got in your course pack. Yeah. Like the SA node tails and the AV node tails?
Yeah, like, can you tell
by
the stuff in?
Sure. Let me start you from the left side picture for SA node,
okay.
Because SA node sits kind of up here toward the top of your right atrium, and when it fires an impulse, it tells your two atria to get ready to contract, and then they contract in response. And that forces the blood down through open AV valves. It collects down here in the two ventricles. Then your AV node gets a message, and it sits about right here, right close to your interventricular septum. And then your AV node sends a message to the bundle of His right there at the interventricular septum. It splits into two bundle branches, a left and a right bundle branch. And those bundle branches travel up the walls of your ventricles, forming Purkinje fibers. And those Purkinje fibers fire a nerve impulse that tell your two ventricles to depolarize, and then they contract in response. That kind of what you needed to hear? Okay. How about anything else I can help clarify or review for you? So I'd like to share with you a couple of issues here about halfway down your page, if you're still on page 43 with me. Abnormal heart sounds. So with the stethoscope, a doctor can listen and determine what may be going on in terms of valve issues. So one valve issue could be called an incompetent valve. And an incompetent valve is one that doesn't close properly. Now keep in mind, our whole goal here with valves is to ensure a one-way flow of blood through the heart and to prevent backflow. So if it's not closing properly, we would say it's incompetent because blood flows backwards through that valve. Why do you think the aorta is commonly an incompetent valve? Why not the pulmonary trunk's valve?
Pressure.
Yeah, it's all about pressure. So, you know, if you've got 120 millimeters mercury of pressure passing through you every 0.8 seconds, my goodness, no wonder there's valve issues with that aortic valve. So if blood regurgitates, meaning it leaks backward, into what chamber is it going to be leaking back down into? Left ventricle, yeah. So it goes back down into the left ventricle. So that means that we're not fulfilling our ejection fraction. Instead of, say, 50 to 65%, we may be doing 40% ejection fraction. What does that mean for your cells and tissues? Yep, not getting enough oxygen. So having an incompetent valve may lead to issues like not enough oxygen going to the brain or the body's cells and tissues. Let's see, a stenotic valve is one that has become more narrow. This is an aortic stenotic valve. You can see that it looks like it's got a rather small opening right here in the middle. And again, if you've got a narrowed valve, what happens to your ejection fraction? It's lower, yeah. So what is stroke volume normally? 70 milliliters, right. And if you're only getting, say, 50 milliliters through a tiny little opening like that, you've still got the same problem, perfusion of oxygen out to your cells and tissues. So, yes, yeah, stenotic valves and incompetent valves ultimately result in a reduced ejection fraction. This is one that we've probably all heard of. It's called a heart murmur sometimes. It's just a catch-all term for a valve issue. And an MVP is not your most valuable player. This is a big valve problem because it's left side of the heart. Why is the left side of the heart, again, the culprit? Yeah, high pressure. This is a side that sends blood out to the body. Good. So the mitral valve can prolapse, which means it can droop or sag down into your left ventricle. It should stay firm. It should close properly when the ventricle contracts. But if it's kind of a sagging, drooping valve, what happens to it when ventricular systole occurs? Good. Yeah, blood is sent back into your left atrium. And of course, that is, again, less blood that gets pumped out through ventricular systole. So once again, you may have a reduced ejection fraction because of this particular valve issue.
Can you ever grow out of that?
They say you can, but you know, once you reach a certain age, I don't think it's not something that you're going to grow out of anymore. I know with children, they sometimes watch them, but I think once you're past a certain age, and I don't know what age that is, it's something, it's an effect you're going to either live with or have surgery for. Yep. And they can do a sonogram and actually see the blood spewing backwards, you know, through the valves. So it's an easy thing to detect if they use a sonogram. Okay. How about questions on any of those valve issues? Did you catch your question there by the MVP? okay? Because it's all pressure issues, right? Well, and there's also a more direct pathway. There's one less branch from the heart to the left arm than there is to the right arm. So that why they use a left side pressure sometimes, it's because it's going to have a more accurate read for the left side of the heart pressure. So bottom of your page has cardiac output. This is kind of getting into a new territory. Every minute your blood pumps about 5 liters of blood, and that's what we refer to as your cardiac output. So if you do the math, it actually works out to be about 5.25, but that's roughly 5 liters that everybody circulates every minute. Now we know the range is a little higher for males because of the body size and testosterone. We know, of course, for females a little lower than that. But on average, we're just going to go with around 5 or 5.25 liters of blood for your typical cardiac output. So cardiac output depends on two variables, stroke volume and heart rate. We already know what these are. Stroke volume is how much blood you eject from the left ventricle or the right ventricle with every contraction. How much blood is this? 70 milliliters, good. And we know heart rate at rest is assumed to be how many beats per minute? 75, right. So if you multiply 70 times 75, you get 5,250 milliliters per minute. If we do the metric conversion from milliliters to liters, that equals 5.25 liters of blood circulated through your body every minute. So that's the average value that we're going to assume for the average human being. Okay? Let's talk about some things that influence stroke volume, heart rate, and cardiac output. That comes from page 44. Okay, so we talked a little bit about this stuff last class period. Let me walk you through this. When blood is coming from your two atria, draining down through your AV valves and into your two ventricles, which of these three volumes is collected in those two ventricles?
End-diastolic.
Good. End-diastolic volume. And that's about 120 milliliters of blood. When those two ventricles contract, they're going to pump blood out through the two large arteries. How much blood is ejected? 70 milliliters, good. So we eject out 70, that's our stroke volume. And that leaves behind in each ventricle how much blood? 50 milliliters, and that volume is known as? ESV for systolic, good. So we can rearrange the equation. Stroke volume also means end diastolic minus end systolic will give you stroke volume. So you can rearrange this equation as you need, but nonetheless, we see the relationship that stroke volume, how much you pump out, actually relies on how much blood drains into the ventricles versus how much is left behind after the contraction event. So I just want to tie back that concept in with this conversation. Do you have any questions on how we got the math here? So about halfway down your page, you've got three factors affecting stroke volume, and we've got preload, contractility, and afterload. So let's talk through those three factors. Preload is what comes into your heart. So we've just gone through three volumes here. Which volume is pretty equitable to the volume of blood coming into the ventricles? EDV, right. So preload and EDV are about the same thing. So, your heart muscle is stretching. If you're sending 120 milliliters of blood into each ventricle, the walls begin to stretch as that blood fills up those ventricles. So the preload is what you're loading into the heart every time blood returns from the veins. And we know the veins come from the body and from the lungs. And that blood drains back into the two atria and then down into the two ventricles. So the walls of the ventricles stretch with the preload. Okay? On your sheet there, you'll notice that preload is increased by anything that increases the volume of blood coming back to the heart. So if you're exercising and you're sending a lot of blood back to the heart, that's going to increase the preload or the stretch of those ventricle walls. You'll notice that preload is decreased by nitroglycerin. That's a vasodilator. People take nitroglycerin tabs to help reduce the demand for oxygen by the heart muscle tissue, so that will decrease the amount of stretch experienced by the walls of the ventricles. If I had to remember one word for preload, it would be the stretch. That's the stretch those ventricle walls experience. Okay? Let's talk about contractility. I want you to think about underwear for just a moment, because muscle tissue is like underwear. If you've bought brand new underwear, the elastic waistband is great. You let go of it, it pops back into shape. That's great elasticity. Not only does it stretch, but it recoils back to its original shape. When the underwear's time is up and you stretch that waistband, you let go of it, and it doesn't stretch back or pop back to its original shape, you know it's lost its elasticity. So that's not what we want to think of in terms of healthy muscle tissue. Healthy muscle tissue should stretch and then let go. It should pop back into its original shape. That recoilability is what we're looking for. So contractility is the strength of the muscle contraction. If I stretch the muscle tissue really far and I let go, it's going to contract really strong. If I only stretch it a little bit and let go, the contraction is less strong. So what do you think exercise does to your heart muscle tissue? Stretches it, and you want it to snap back, right? And so over time, your heart becomes very efficient at stretching and then popping back to its original shape. That is healthy muscle tissue. So that means the strength of contraction comes from the snapping back or the recoilability. So the greater the stretch, that's the preload, the greater or stronger the muscles contract. So contractility deals with the strength of the muscle contraction. This kind of takes you back a little bit to Bio-210. So let me kind of remind you of what calcium does from Bio-210. Calcium ions help reveal binding sites on muscle tissue. So when calcium is present, you're actually going to have a stronger muscle contraction. Likewise, sympathetic nervous system stimulation comes from two hormones. Do you recall what those were? Good. Epinephrine and norepinephrine, they too increase the strength of muscle contraction. Think about a time when somebody has scared you to death or you've been really upset and nervous. You can feel your heart just about to beat out of your chest. That is the contractility or the strength of the muscle contraction that's been increased.
So is that the reason why, like, the gigantamine and stuff where, like, your heart beat really fast? Is it because it's getting so used to contract, like, going, stretching out and in and out, and so it wears out the muscle, and that's what makes it hard to pump blood towards the body?
Right, and if it's doing so where it stretches and it doesn't have strength to contract with, then it's actually going to be flabby, so then it contracts faster to get more blood out more quickly. Yeah. So it's just it's a positive feedback, actually. So what comes in must go out. What comes in is the stretch or the preload. What goes out is called the afterload. So in order to get the blood out of the heart, we have to have enough pressure behind that blood. And we think of pressure and afterload as kind of being the same thing. So you're trying to pump up through those two large arteries and get the blood ejected from the heart. So afterload is going to really influence how much blood you get out into circulation. Preload directly influences afterload, but think about this. Does afterload really influence preload? Let me repeat that. Preload directly influences afterload. What comes in influences what comes out, right? But does afterload actually influence preload?
No.
Because where are you going when you leave the heart? To the body. And there's a lot of stuff you travel through before you ever come back to the heart. So the preload does influence the afterload, but the afterload actually has fairly little influence over the preload. There's a lot that can happen between the exit route here of the heart and the time you come back in a minute or so later. Okay, so on your sheet there, I did leave you some issues that will increase or decrease various things like contractility and afterload. Let me make sure to mention those things for contractility. Why do you think hypercalcemia or excess calcium makes your heart beat stronger? What is calcium doing? Right, allowing more muscle to contract. You're revealing those binding sites on the actin filaments, and that makes your muscles contract more strong or with more strength. That is the key word for contractility. Increased sympathetic stimulation also increases the strength of contraction, as does glycogen, or glucagon rather, thyroxine. Those kinds of hormones also make available sugars, and the metabolic rate will increase when you have those available for the heart muscle tissue. Digitalis, you'll notice, is mentioned there for people who have weak heart, maybe heart failure. Digitalis actually increases the strength of contraction. There's a fine line, though, to walk, because if you increase the strength of contraction, you may not want to also increase the rate of contraction. So there's a fine line between strength and increasing the rate. Notice what will decrease contractility or strength: hyperkalemia. What is that condition?
Too much potassium.
That'll actually slow your heart's strength of contraction. Unfortunately, it can also stop your heart from working altogether. And then notice there's other drugs called calcium channel blockers that can also lower the strength of contraction of your heart contractility. Okay, so that kind of leads us into the next topic, which is on your page 45. How about questions on preload, contraction, and afterload? Okay, so let's talk about some things that will increase your heart rate. So now our focus is not heart volume. Now our focus is, of course, the rate. We're assuming a 75 beat per minute heart rate. So what are the two hormones or neurotransmitters that work on behalf of the sympathetic nervous system?
Epinephrine and norepinephrine.
Good, epinephrine and norepinephrine. They increase heart rate. So I want to introduce you to a drug called a beta blocker. And beta blockers block the effects of norepinephrine and epinephrine on the heart. So, do you think the job of a beta blocker is to increase heart rate or decrease heart rate? Decrease, yeah. So, people that take beta blockers will have a slower resting heart rate and, in fact, may have a lower blood pressure to boot. Even when blood pressure is not the problem, it also tends to lower the blood pressure, too. So, I take a beta blocker, and you guys may notice that half the time I have a water bottle sitting up here on the table, okay? Beta blockers also happen to lower your blood volume or cardiac output, so you get dehydrated more easily. I have to watch getting too dehydrated from the beta blocker, but I have something called supraventricular tachycardia or fast heart rate. So the beta blocker lowers my resting heart rate to around 75 beats per minute, but then it also lowers the load of blood volume being circulated. So people who take beta blockers to lower the effects of or reduce the effects of epinephrine and norepinephrine may also run the risk of being dehydrated. So thus the water bottle that I carry with me all the time. Let's talk about hormones. We just did epinephrine and norepinephrine. What effect does thyroxine have on your body?
Increases
metabolic rate. Good. It too will increase your heart rate. Glucagon raises blood sugar, so it too will make more sugar available for your heart. That will also increase your heart rate. Okay, let's talk about ions. These are the two most important ones, calcium and potassium. So why is calcium important for heart muscle contraction? Good. Got to allow it to bind across or cross bridges to connect. You may recall we've talked about, this picture before. Calcium binds to that troponin complex, reveals the binding sites. That allows cross bridges to occur. So you've got to have ample calcium in your bloodstream for heart muscle tissue to work properly. But excess can be detrimental. So a case of hypercalcemia can be bad for us. There are drugs called alpha blockers that actually block calcium levels from your heart, and that too can lower the heart rate. But that's totally different from a beta blocker. Alpha blockers block calcium. Beta blockers block epinephrine and norepinephrine.
Mr. Taylor,
yeah.
Where you got that point where it says epinephrine increases and norepinephrine increases blank and blood pressure?
What y'all think?
Heart rate.
Okay, so yeah. It is heart rate, sure
I
is. Okay, so let's think about hyperkalemia for just a moment. What gland in the body do you think might be hypersecreting a hormone that could lead to hyperkalemia? Parathyroid, yep, sure could. So if you've got parathyroid gland issues, that in fact could raise your heart rate due to the availability of calcium in your bloodstream. Let's think glands again. What gland controls potassium levels in your bloodstream? Adrenal's good. And what hormone specifically?
Aldosterone,
right. So if you have an adrenal issue or an aldosterone issue, to be more specific, that could end up with a case of low blood potassium levels. So low blood potassium is called hypokalemia. What is the concern with having too little potassium? This is digging way back in your brain. Way back in your brain.
No chance to get repolarization.
Right. If you've got too little potassium, you won't repolarize, so your muscle cells stay a little more excitable, and so they're more apt to contract if there's just a little stimulus there. So low potassium means that your heart becomes a little too excited. So the resting heart rate may not be negative 70 millivolts. Maybe it's closer to threshold. So all you take is just a little bit of excitement to push that muscle cell over to the contraction side. Could it cause what?
Muscle twitching,
yes, very much. Weak muscle contractions, but muscle twitches nonetheless. Yeah. All right, temperature is another issue. So high temperature, like a fever, can induce a fast heart rate because now we've got more oxygen and more sugar available and the heart rate's going to increase. And our favorite drug of all is caffeine. So many of us are hooked on our caffeinated drinks like soft drinks and sweet tea. Caffeine also is a stimulant for our heart and increases heart rate. So let's talk about decreasing heart rate. Parasympathetic nervous system is actually your primary control system here. It is the one that dominates your heart and is trying to maintain a slower resting heart rate. It's trying to antagonize the effects of epinephrine and norepinephrine. Do you recall the name of the neurotransmitter that works for the parasympathetic nervous system?
Acetylcholine.
Good. ACH or acetylcholine. That is your blank, by the way. So let me reintroduce the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is cranial nerve number 10. Why is it unusual? Its nickname is the wanderer, and it wanders away from your brain. Unlike other cranial nerves that stay close to your brain, The vagus nerve wanders away and innervates lots of our organs, including the heart. So you can see this vagus nerve up here does have a long way to travel to get to our heart. What's the effect of the vagus nerve on the heart's rate? Slow it down, right? Calm and slow. The vagus nerve releases acetylcholine. It antagonizes the sympathetic nervous system and epinephrine and norepinephrine. So the vagus nerve's job is to slow and calm the heart rate using acetylcholine. For those who have a very strong parasympathetic nervous system, you may be more apt to faint. That's what we call vasovagal syncope, or syncope. All of us have vasovagal tone, which means that the parasympathetic nervous system is trying to dominate the heart and keep the heart rate slow. But if you've got an especially strong parasympathetic nervous system, you may pass out more frequently, and in that case, they may prescribe a medication to actually increase your heart rate. You'll notice that atropine works against the vagus nerve. Do you think atropine raises heart rate or lowers heart rate? It raises, yeah, increases heart rate, exactly. I want to talk to you for just a moment about the vasovagal syncope and the vagal maneuver, because if you'll read there about the vagal maneuver, it says that this comes from gagging, coughing, holding your breath, and even dunking your face in ice water. So these all don't sound like very comfortable activities, but you know, sometimes people may get choked on something, they're coughing really hard, or perhaps they have a very bad bronchial or respiratory infection and they're coughing really hard. That puts a load on the vagus nerve to slow the heart rate. So under those kinds of activities, you can slow the heart rate to the point of passing out and lowering your blood pressure. So I make this mention because I know a lot of you are heading into the nursing field and a future working in with elderly people may be in your cards. So elderly people take medications that slow their heart rate, like beta blockers and alpha blockers. And then, of course, older people have drugs that make it hard to have a bowel movement. So they sit on the toilet and they strain. So now we have to turn around and give them some kind of stool softener, because what happens if you sit on the toilet and hold your breath and strain? Pass out, exactly. So now your elderly patient's passed out, he fell off the toilet, he hit his head. Now you've got a bigger problem than just having a constipated elderly patient. So that's the issue here, is that holding your breath can actually cause passing out due to vasovagal stimulation. So it all is linked together. This, by the way, is how Elvis died. They say he was on a bunch of medications, drugs, was sitting on the toilet having a bowel movement, apparently held his breath too hard or too long, and that was it. So he died on the toilet. That was the story for him. So the story is, don't hold your breath when you're having a bowel movement, right? Okay. Last little bit here. Ions do play a role. It's the opposite setup this time. Low calcium can induce heart arrhythmias, and high potassium can actually cause your heart to completely stop. Okay, so excess potassium is a bad thing. And again, what hormone is to blame? Could be aldosterone, right? In fact, insulin could also play a role here. We'll talk more about insulin's role when we do acid-base balance. That is a rather thick page of information. Is there anything I can clarify for you there? Do you have any questions on that page? Just a little bit left. We've got page 46 with some heart issues. CHF stands for a couple of things. It stands for congestive heart failure, chronic heart fatigue. Either way, the outcome is not good, because this means the heart is failing as a pump. This is a positive feedback mechanism that sends the heart into a downward spiral. So congestive heart failure or chronic heart fatigue is caused by a lifetime of clogged vessels called coronary atherosclerosis. High blood pressure is something that goes undetected. You know, every year your blood pressure could creep up a little bit, and if you're not constantly watching your pressure, it could continue to creep up and cause heart muscle damage. Multiple heart attacks cause heart muscle tissue to be replaced with scar tissue. Does scar tissue have good contractility? No, it doesn't stretch, and it doesn't snap back through contractility. So cardiac muscle tissue damage is certainly not a good thing. And what is dilated myocardiopathy? Ventricles stretch and get flabby. So the harder your heart works to pump blood, the flabbier it can get if there's obstacles in the way, such as clogged vessels. Those clogged vessels make your heart work even harder. So you can see this is a positive feedback loop that doesn't result in having your heart work more efficiently. It makes your heart work harder and more flabby. So this particular case here of chronic heart fatigue or chronic heart failure or congestive heart failure is an out of control issue that never results in anything good happening. Let me explain that there's two kinds of heart failure. There's left side and right side. If the left ventricle fails as a pump, it cannot pump blood out through the aorta. So backflow it with me. From the left ventricle, it goes backwards through which valve?
Mitral
valve, backwards into the left atrium, backwards into the pulmonary veins, and then into the lungs, right? So you can see here, these are lung issues, pulmonary congestion, pulmonary edema. People feel like they're suffocating, they can't catch their breath. That comes from the left side failing as a pump. Look at right side heart failure. If the right ventricle is ineffective as a pump, backflow it through the tricuspid valve, right atrium, and then you've got a choice, SVC and IVC. If you're standing up, which one do you think the blood flows into? IVC, right. And then it goes back into your veins, it feeds into your arms and your legs. That blood pools in those locations, and then now we have peripheral congestion and edema. This is a case of taking off the socks and they've left an indentation. Or your rings and jewelry have left an indentation, you can't get those off. So swelling, pinning edema in the periphery is a sign of right side heart failure. So what may start as a left side or a right side failure will not stay there. Ultimately, one side of the heart is compensating for the other side, and both sides will eventually fail. And so if that is the case, then we end up seeing things like a heart transplant being the final option for a person with congestive heart failure. There may be medications like diuretics given, but ultimately the treatment for this is going to be a heart transplant. Okay, so that should cover page 45. I do want to remind you that the backflow is where the blood goes. That's what makes this page tricky to get straight. Do you have any questions on the two sides of heart failure? Let's talk about heart attacks and angina on page 47. So what is an MI or myocardial infarction? What happens? So what happens during a heart attack?
Lack of oxygen to the heart muscle.
Right, lack of oxygen to the heart muscle. What could cause the lack of oxygen to the heart muscle?
Blockage.
Blockage, right. Good. So there probably is a blockage in a coronary artery. Sometimes what happens is there is a buildup of plaque inside a vessel. If that plaque ruptures and floats free, it can create a blockage. That blockage can cause a heart attack or death of muscle tissue where that area is being starved of oxygen. The difference between a heart attack and angina is time. Angina is short-term lack of oxygen. This may come from exercise, perhaps climbing a hill, climbing a set of stairs, but long-term deprivation of oxygen, which results in tissue death, that's when we classify it as a myocardial infarction. I detailed some stuff on your paper for you. There are particular tests that can differentiate between types of muscle tissue damage. So let me explain. Let's take a couch potato. He decides that his yard needs some work. So on a crisp, cool fall afternoon, he spends an entire Saturday afternoon raking his yard, cleaning his yard, bagging up leaves, and works really hard, and something he's not used to. Monday morning, he's got some chest pain, so he goes and gets checked out at the emergency room. So he didn't bother to explain that on Saturday he worked really hard in the yard doing a lot of physical activity that he's not used to doing. You'll notice on your sheet there's a couple of chemicals they can test for. One is troponin, the other one is creatine kinase. If they only run a troponin test, it's going to come back and show muscle tissue damage. But does it specify what type of muscle tissue? No. So if they just run a troponin test, they may say, hey, you've got muscle tissue damage, you've had a heart attack. But that doesn't distinguish between cardiac muscle damage and skeletal muscle damage. So what is a more specific test for cardiac muscle damage? Creatine kinase, right. So CK or creatine kinase, that one is specific to cardiac muscle tissue. So that should be performed to tell whether or not you have, say, skeletal muscle tissue that's just been damaged from overactivity, or specifically heart muscle tissue. And so CK confirms heart muscle tissue damage. Short-term solutions could be medical, such as a beta blocker or an ACE inhibitor, but we know that long-term damage may result in things like a bypass surgery, something of that sort. I do want to mention the symptoms of heart attack.
Ms. Taylor, in the notes, it's backwards.
Is it backwards?
Well, you just said yes, ma'am.
Okay. Flip, that's fine. They go with what the course pack has.
Okay.
I got them flip-flop when I was talking about it.
Okay.
Thanks. You guys know the typical heart attack symptoms, right? Okay. Shortness of breath. Why pain in the left arm, left jaw area?
Referred pain.
Yep. So you feel your heart pain on the left side because of the mixture of nerves and the networks that crisscross. Okay. Other symptoms, such as nausea or vomiting, actually are parasympathetic nervous system trying to override and slow the heart rate back down. So those kinds of flu-like symptoms actually are the parasympathetic nervous system attempting kind of calming things back down. I do want to mention that females have different symptoms than males. Besides the typical symptoms, how might a female feel differently? Backache, pain in the back, okay, about where the heart is, but on the back side. What else might a female feel? Jaw pain, yep. Females may also have very little symptoms. One of them may be extreme fatigue. So how many women do you know in your life that have said, it's okay, I'm just really tired right now, it'll pass, I'll be okay? You know, and so that kind of ignorance of saying, hey, the fatigue is gonna pass, it's all right, may in fact be the only warning sign that female gets for an impending heart attack. I had a student in class about 2 years ago, and we talked about these warning signs. And she was probably early 50s at that point, and she said that she had been having some of these symptoms, the chest pain, the fatigue, the shortness of breath, but she didn't really think it was enough to see her doctor over. Well, she went that week and got checked. She did not come back to my class. She had a three-way bypass surgery and was out for about a year. And then she came back, I think it was about a semester or two ago, and she actually finished up her Bio-211 course. So, you know, she was one of those that was ignoring the symptoms and just saying, it's okay, it'll pass, but I guess us talking about it made them click for her, and she realized that they weren't just random symptoms that meant nothing. They were actually all pointing to heart attack issues. So she was able to avoid having a heart attack, but unfortunately she did need a three-way bypass to eliminate those blockages.
I wonder if she had any of the other risk factors, like diabetes or obesity or, you know.
I don't think she was obese. She never mentioned diabetes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it could have been diet or genetics. She didn't ever say what the underlying problems were, but you're right, there could have been something else going on there.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys have covered these fetal bypasses in lab, right? Do you need to hear them again? good to go. I see no's for the most part. Okay. All right. So that does wrap up this page for you on the bottom of 47. Just for a few minutes, I'm going to get you started with blood vessels. We're not going to go a whole far distance on this topic today. This is chapter 18. It starts on page 51. So in terms of just generic blood vessel structure, we know that most blood vessels have three layers, and those three layers are called tunics or tunicas. We're going to start with the tunica intima, which is your innermost layer. That innermost layer is sometimes called the endothelium, made up of our simple squamous epithelial tissue. By the way, that tunica intima is actually continuous with the endocardium of your heart. So it is one continuous layer of simple squamous from your heart throughout all of your blood vessels. That's why if you have, say, a heart infection like endocarditis, it can spread and become an infection in your vessels as well, causing phlebitis. So that's kind of the nature of the beast of the way we're constructed. The middle region is called tunica media, and this region contains some smooth muscle and autonomic nerves. So what do you know about smooth muscle? Involuntary, not striated. It moves things along by peristalsis. So what is peristalsis? All of y'all are doing it, yeah. Rhythmic contraction, so it's squeezing and then it's relaxing. So that does help to milk along blood in our vessels, especially in the arteries. There's also collagen fibers in the tunica adventitia or externa, and they're like giving a steel cable hug to the vessel, preventing it from flexing open too far. We want to make sure that it doesn't get too dilated because it can rupture and that could cause death. So in the adventitia layer are some steel-like collagen fibers. I do want to mention this issue of vasodilation and vasoconstriction. Your vessels, specifically the arteries, have an autonomic nervous system wiring, and they are wired back to your brain, and your brain can tell your vessels to constrict if necessary, causing vasoconstriction. So what happens to your vessel diameter when it constricts? Gets narrower, right? So under what circumstances might you want to constrict your vessels?
Cold.
Cold, yeah, definitely cold.
Bleeding,
good. We may also want to limit blood flow to a particular area. We may want to vasoconstrict. And for our discussion, vasoconstriction raises blood pressure. Okay, so if you squeeze the garden hose is going to shoot out higher pressured fluid. That's what happens to our blood vessels. When you squeeze them, the blood flow has a higher pressure. Now, we can also let our vessels relax. In that case, our vessels get bigger in diameter. The opening has more room for blood to flow through, and this is called vasodilation. Now, what happens to blood pressure? It goes down. Yes, so dilation relaxes the vessels, decreases pressure. Vasoconstriction increases pressure. Okay, so let's talk about arteries for just a moment. We know that on models they're colored red. In reality, all vessels have a somewhat red color to them, so just want to put that out there. In what direction do arteries always transport blood? Away from the heart, right. So they carry blood away from the heart. Almost always that blood is oxygenated. There's an exception in the heart. Pulmonaries, right. So arteries have a thicker tunica media than do veins. Why do you think that's the case?
Higher pressure,
right. They got more smooth muscle. They're accommodating higher pressure because we have to accommodate pressure as high as 120 millimeters mercury coming off that aorta. So I'd like to share with you two types of arteries, One type of artery is an elastic artery. Another type is called a muscular artery. The elastic arteries, in fact, have more elastic tissue in them, which means they're stretchier. Muscular arteries have more smooth muscle and less elasticity. So let's take the elastic ones first. Notice where they're located. These are the arteries closest to your heart. You've got aorta, pulmonary trunk, common carotid, and subclavians. All of those operate under the highest pressure right around your heart. So they need the stretchiness that elasticity provides. Muscular arteries are further away from your heart. That smooth muscle can contract or can relax to modify blood pressure. So these are typically named for a location, such as the femoral artery into the leg, popliteal, radial, brachial. All of those with a specific location name are most likely going to be an muscular artery. The exception, of course, being subclavian, that has a location name in it, but that is still an elastic one, being close to the heart. I do want to mention that these muscular arteries are great for pulse points. So let's talk about taking the pulse for just a moment. The pulse is best taken using two or three fingers, but never the thumb. Why avoid the thumb?
Has a pulse.
Has a pulse, right. If you use your thumb, you're actually doing your own pulse, right? Okay. There are some locations that are great for pulse taking. They're showing us this one here, radial. Where are some other places you can take the pulse? Good. So why don't we just start at the head and go down, because you guys are, you told me, temporal, right? Carotid. Where else in the head area? That's probably it. Armpit has an axillary. Yep. Brachial, yep. Arm brachial, radial, femoral, popliteal.
Ankle.
There's ankle, good, and there's pedal in your foot, okay? And then there's actually an apical pulse here, the apex of the heart, so that's also a pulse point. So no matter where you choose to take the pulse, we of course avoid the thumb because of its own pulse. Two fingers can work or three fingers can work. If you use the three-finger approach as shown here, then you use your ring finger and your middle finger to push down on the blood flow, cutting it off, and then you gently use your ring finger, or your first finger, index finger there, to lightly detect the pulse. So I told you I was on a beta blocker for heart rate issues, and when I first went on the medication, I couldn't feel my heart rate anymore using the two-finger approach. So they suggested that you use three fingers, and the last two fingers, of course, cut off the blood supply. And for a person who has a hard-to-detect pulse, that may be the trick in actually feeling a very weak or not a very strong pulse. So now y'all are all trying it with the try it with the two fingers, try it with the three. You know, if you have somebody who's elderly on medication, that three-finger approach may be the trick. How about questions so far? So these are elastic arteries. They have a lot of elasticity in their walls, and that's basically because they're stretching with high pressure passing through. Notice the muscular artery has very little elastic fibers because its job is to contract and constrict that vessel's diameter, or relax and, of course, let more blood flow through. So two types of arteries, two different functions there. Let's talk about veins for just a moment. In what direction do veins typically carry their blood?
To the heart.
To the heart, good. And of course, they have a thinner tunica media because?
Low pressure.
Low pressure, right. So there is less accommodation for the stretchiness. We don't have the stretchy issue here. And veins also don't really do a whole lot of contraction. Some of the larger veins can contract to help move blood back to your heart. But for the most part, we have to rely on your skeletal muscle activity and your breathing to get that blood flow back. Now, we know that there's two exceptions for your pulmonary veins and arteries. Those two are opposite in color. So once again, most veins on models are colored blue, with the exception of those pulmonaries on our models. Okay. So let me take you to the very bottom of your page. Let's explore three ways that our veins can help get blood back to the heart. So think about standing up. Gravity is working against you. Gravity is pulling your blood down towards your feet. If you've got blood in your legs, it's trying to get back to your heart. It's having to work against gravity and travel 4, 5, or 6 feet back up to where your heart is located. So one thing that assists with blood flow and return back to your heart are valves. So what do the valves prevent from happening?
Backflow,
yeah. So you can see a set of valves here. If the blood makes its way through, the valve closes and hopefully prevents the blood from pooling and backflowing in the previous location. Now we do know that those valves can fail. What do you call failed valves and veins? Varicose, yeah. So varicose veins can of course cause blood to accumulate in the extremities, as you can see here. They can do surgery nowadays to help eliminate those varicose veins. And to avoid blood clots in veins, we also can apply pneumatic leg pumps. So that too can help to encourage the valve activity and move that blood flow back to the heart. Let's go back to our list. In addition to valves, skeletal muscle activity also helps to milk along the blood in our veins. So what can you do to encourage skeletal muscle activity?
Exercise,
right. Being physically mobile is one good way to return the blood back to your heart. Okay? And then finally, breathing. You don't necessarily think of this as being an assist, but taking a deep breath of air lowers the pressure in your thoracic cavity. And how does blood flow? From high pressure to low pressure, right? So it literally gets moved from your veins to the negative pressure in your chest, and that gets it back into blood flow. So why don't we call it a day at the bottom of this page? I'll make a note that we need to fill in the blank on Wednesday, and then we'll pick up and go on to the next page.